A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 52. This is the podcast all about British science fiction and fantasy television. And today we are continuing our discussion of Neverwhere. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. So Neverwhere, 1996, BBC series, 6 episodes, about 30 minutes each episode. And Neverwhere is set in a fantasy world below the streets of London, that goes by the name of London Below.
As opposed to London Above.
As London Above. Although it does, from time to time, they do stray onto the rooftops of London, which is quite interesting as well. And our hero, Richard Mayhew, has become involved with a young woman from London Below called Dor, or the Lady Dor, as she's sometimes referred to. And she is on a mission to find an angel called Islington, and to find out who murdered her family, and to avenge her family if she possibly can. And Richard has been sort of caught up in this mission of hers, along with a few other interesting characters along the way.
As you may have guessed, if you didn't hear our first half on this, from the angel Islington, a large part of Neverwhere is based on the names of tube stations, that is, the London subway stations, and on places in London, and taking these place names and then using them literally. So we get this sort of ancient, quasi-medieval fantasy world with the idea that maybe the place names that we use now were derived from this mysterious world of London Below. And part of what we get with this is the classic hero quest. We have a lot of that in here, starting with a young man who is plucked from his ordinary life. That is Richard Mayhew, who is this young businessman in London Above, who becomes involved with London Below and essentially stuck in London Below and having to follow events there. And there is a princess in trouble, the Lady Dor in this case, who is the damsel in distress who Richard rescues and then is drawn into this whole world of London Below and into her world and her quest and his own quest, which in part involves getting home. So you get lots of these sort of quest ideas in here.
And so as well as a hero, and he needs a princess, he also needs to have some memorable villains. And here in Neverwhere, we've got the characters of Mr. Croup and Mr. Vandemar, who are certainly very villainous, although, as we suggested last time, they may just be the henchmen. And one of the mysteries of Neverwhere is who are they actually working for. But they're certainly marvellous villains. Mr. Croup, who likes to elaborate and speak quite poetically and precisely, and Mr. Vandemar with his sort of special talents for mayhem and violence and descriptions of torture. Great villains for the hero to go up against. And along the way, he's also got to meet some weird and wonderful characters who may or may not help him out. The fantastic Patterson Joseph as the Marquis de Carabas fits that role. And we've also got Hunter, the bodyguard. We've got a wonderful little performance by Trevor Peacock as Old Bailey, a character who lives on the roofs of London and sort of collects birds and lives in this huge coat of feathers. We've got the rather strange Velvets, who stalk the streets of London Below and have sort of almost like vampire type characters. We've got the mysterious rat speakers. So lots of strange characters along the way, all with this fantastic imagination from Neil Gaiman, the writer.
Yes, it's this very elaborate fantasy world that involves characters like the Velvets, who are these female, almost vampires, but not quite vampires. And you have characters like the Earl, who is on a tube car, like a subway train car, and holds his court there, and that's Earl's Court, the tube station. The Earl sort of fills the quest idea of, I think it's sometimes called the old man in the woods, the older character that the hero meets partway through who gives them a bit more guidance to continue on his way. So there are many of those elements there.
Yep. I think that's right. He does fit the old man character, the old man in the woods who gives out advice and guidance. And also, a hero may need a special weapon. I suppose classically he needs a magic sword or he needs a lightsaber. And we won't give too much away because it does reveal some of the plot, but I think we can hint that there is a special weapon somewhere along the way for Richard, which will have significance to his quest. And as you're getting the impression, you know, we can see parallels between the story of Neverwhere and classic stories like Lord of the Rings or Star Wars, which we've mentioned a few times, more sort of perhaps more traditional hero legends such as Beowulf. And even, you know, the movie The Wizard of Oz, which we've come back to a few times, with the mysterious character of the angel Islington, who's a bit like the wizard they're trying to get to, who will solve their mysteries and put things right and get Richard back to his original home.
Yes, there are one or two overt references to The Wizard of Oz that you will most likely recognize when you come across those. There is even the idea of the destiny to face some terrible enemy that we know will become a confrontation at the climax of the story. So all of these types of elements are really there. And you have the idea of Richard having to undergo an ordeal or a test that comes into it. You have this variety of things happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is, you know, it is classic hero material, but it's nonetheless for that because sometimes these classic story ideas, they survive so long because they work well. We like them, we enjoy them. And I think Neverwhere is no exception.
Yes, they were used very well. And you have the idea of De Carabas, who was sort of a mentor character, sort of not, but sort of a mentor character, going off on his own so the hero can stand on his own and so on and so forth. You have a lot of these different elements that are present, and they were well used, and it gives you a nice shape of story to a lot of it.
Yeah, it's good. I mean, as you say, De Carabas has to sort of divert from the main group, so he has to go off on his own for a while. And we won't say that he has to go off and switch off a tractor beam, but there is that element of him diverting away from the main group and leaving Richard and Dor and Hunter continuing on the quest. And what De Carabas has to do is go and have a rather unpleasant meeting with the sort of grim, grisly and very vicious Croup and Vandemar. And he has to do that in order to find out more about the underlying mystery of what happened to Dor's family. So he finds out and we find out a bit more about what was going on, and the plot starts to unfold.
That sounds a little bit like Gandalf in both The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings, doesn't it?
Now you mention it, there you are. See, another hero quest parallel that we're picking out as we're going along. Yes, these have elements, they start to come out when you start to take Neverwhere apart a bit, don't they? And while that's going on, Richard and Dor are forced to travel in London above. And Richard sort of encounters some of the elements of his former life. And in particular, he encounters Jessica, his fiancée, who no longer recognises him and no longer remembers that they were engaged for 18 months. It's quite a nice scene. It works quite well. You get this sort of feeling of sadness, but also a bit of comedy when he can surprise her with some of the details he knows about her, which she doesn't understand how he can possibly know. So interesting stuff as they travel into the British Museum.
It sort of reinforces his situation that he really is in this other world and he's cut off from what he had before. And of course, you also had Hunter, the assisting warrior character, with a destiny of her own, going off to encounter the legendary Beast of London. So you have some nice little mythological ideas and the idea of it sort of building its own mythology, which is quite nice.
They say that Merlin's master, Blaise, once wrote a reel so beguiling it would charm the coins from the pockets of anyone who heard it.
That'd be worth more than just a timetable, Marquis, if you had it.
Why, then you'd owe me, wouldn't you?
Let me hear the reel first, you old trickster.
So, Neverwhere has produced a few spin-offs, and we like to try and look at some of the spin-offs when we consider these series on British Invaders. So I think we should point out that the TV series did come first. It was originally conceived as a TV show. So we get these six episodes in 1996. But I think it's fair to say, Brian, that Neil Gaiman's imagination spills over. And we know that as he was going through writing the TV show, he kept coming up with extra bits that he wanted to put in.
They just wouldn't fit in, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think they could squeeze it all in. And I know that he, in the introduction to one of the books, he does say that he always thought, well, if I can't get that in the TV show, I'll put it in the book.
That's right. There were things that he wanted to put into the TV version that just wouldn't go. And I think a lot of that was probably related to budget at the time. But he did write a novel version of Neverwhere for BBC Books in 1996. And it was quite close to the broadcast TV version of Neverwhere. I believe there was actually a limit on the word count or the page count for that book. So he still had restrictions to how much he could put into the novel, and it still wasn't able to hold everything he wanted to put into it.
So he managed to expand it slightly the following year when he brought out the American paperback version in 97. And I think there he managed to get in some more of the ideas that had spilled over from the TV series. I haven't read it, but I know it does feature extra bits and pieces that we didn't see on screen, and I think a bit more information about the characters of Croup and Vandemar. And then we get what's now known as the author's preferred text version, Neil Gaiman's preferred version, which he brought out in 2005. And this is the one I have read, and that certainly has got a lot more sections in it and quite a bit about the background of Croup and Vandemar, and some of the sequences from the TV show are considerably expanded, and we get to know a bit more about some minor characters like one of the young rat speakers and so on along the way. And it's a very good book. It's got some extra information in the back from Neil Gaiman and his introduction as well. And if you enjoy the TV series, that's the version I think to hunt out and have a go at as well.
Yes, make sure you have the 2005 version of Neverwhere, not the 96 or 97 version.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the one to look for. And it's probably the easiest one to find now anyway, because it's, I think, Neil Gaiman's such a popular author that I think they have his preferred version now on all the sites. And then there was a comic book version in 2005, came out in nine separate issues by the comic book writer, or it was adapted by the comic book writer Mike Carey and illustrated by a fairly well-known comic book artist called Glenn Fabry. And they were collected together into a graphic novel or a trade paperback format in 2006. And I've read these, and this has the same basic story as Neverwhere, but interestingly, they change the visuals quite a lot. There's considerable changes. The characters look completely different to the ones that we've seen on the TV show, which is slightly, I found it slightly difficult having seen the TV show first and having got this idea of what I thought the characters looked like, and then to see them portrayed completely differently in the comic book is a little bit unusual. And it does, I think, it causes one or two potential problems with the story, where the way the characters are portrayed just doesn't seem to make sense with the history we know about those characters. But it is an interesting experiment. And if you've read the comic books or the graphic novel collection and you have any comments on that, and particularly on the visuals, I'd be very interested to hear from you. Do let me know through the email or the Facebook group. This is possibly one for Dave and Ange from the Waiting for the Trade podcast. If they get round to covering the Neverwhere graphic novel, perhaps they could let me know about it.
Yes, that would be interesting to hear. I think the graphic novel was more related to the novel from 2005 than it was related to the previous versions and the television version.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it sticks more closely to the novelization. And I think it just does its own thing slightly with the interpretation of the character's appearance, which sometimes works quite well and sometimes just doesn't seem to fit. But as I say, you know, if you read the graphic novel, let me know what you think about the way they're portrayed.
Now, there were also a couple of stage plays based on Neverwhere that were put on in the U.S. The Cardinal Rep in Savannah, Georgia, presented it in 2006. And again, the Actors Gymnasium in Evanston, Illinois, put it on in 2008. And I don't know a lot about those productions, but it's certainly an interesting idea. It's a story that certainly could be presented on the stage. It would be complex to stage it, but it certainly could be. So that's an interesting idea that those stage productions are out there floating around.
Yep. And as ever, if you've ever had the chance to see those and you know anything more about them, do let us know.
Oh, please do. And there has been talk about a sequel to the book for many years, or a sequel to the TV version even, basically since it came out. Neil Gaiman mentioned a possible sequel called The Seven Sisters as a novel, which was mentioned a number of years ago now, I think. But there has not been any detail, and we don't know if that will actually happen, or if so, when.
Yeah, I mean, the story of Neverwhere is sort of, this particular story is self-contained, but the world of Neverwhere, you know, you could well see him going back to explore again and tell other stories such as The Seven Sisters. Or he's also mentioned in a collection of short stories of his, he's mentioned the possibility of a short story or a novella called How the Marquis Got His Coat Back, which obviously featured the Marquis de Carabas. And I think we'd all be interested to have more stories told about the Marquis de Carabas, particularly if we can keep the idea of Patterson Joseph in our mind when we're reading them.
I believe Neil Gaiman said that story was actually half written at this point, or at the point that he mentioned it. And that would certainly be an interesting one because the wheeling and dealing of the Marquis de Carabas is certainly a great feature of this story and this world.
And it sounds like we may actually get to read that one at some point in the future then, Brian.
One never knows.
And then, of course, there'd be the possibility of a film, and whether we'd ever get a film adaptation of Neverwhere or a film set in the Neverwhere world. And I believe that for a while the film rights were actually owned by the Jim Henson Company, but they're now listed as being owned by Harvey Weinstein, who used to be the Miramax production company, but now I think they're out on their own. And it's still listed on IMDb as in pre-production, which obviously I suspect could mean developmental hell. But it's still a chance we may see a film one day.
Well, it would be interesting. It has a lot of potential. People have talked about the idea of a film based more on the novel, the 2005 version of the novel, rather than based on the original TV miniseries. And that has a lot of potential. I certainly would have loved to see the Jim Henson Company. I'd love to see what they're take on it would have been like if they were involved at some point.
Yeah, that would have been great to see it with sort of I won't say Muppet characters, but the sort of Muppet creatures. That's what we want, isn't it? The creature features from the Jim Henson Studios. So let's turn to our thoughts about the series as a whole and the bits that worked very well and the bits that didn't perhaps quite work so convincingly. What would you start to pick out first, Brian?
Well, there are a couple of performances in this that were really very strong. Patterson Joseph as the Marquis de Carabas jumps out. He was a very entertaining character in this. He was able to be kind of a nasty guy and also have that little sense of humor and be sort of endearing in a way all at the same time. That was great. Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandemar were also very fun to watch. They took what were potentially sort of cardboard villain roles and made them really come to life. So those three performances were really very good.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good work on display, but those three really stand out, don't they? They're fantastic. I'm pretty sure this was the first time that I'd seen Patterson Joseph. He's just so watchable in anything he does. And it's just, I think it's fortunate that he's done a lot of genre stuff, so that we've talked about him before in Jekyll, but he's been in the new Doctor Who, and of course he's in the remake of Survivors. And as you say, Krupp and Vandemar, just what fantastic villains, and two actors who are just clearly having so much fun with their parts, and they get so many great lines. You know, the screen just seems to light up whenever they're on.
Yes, the world building in this was also just outstanding. The places and types of people and characters they built up for this were really very vivid, and you get lots of these manipulations of tube station names and place names in London that become these sort of larger than life places that embody those kinds of names, and those types of things were all done really well in this.
Yeah, it is a fantastic world, the world of London below, and the idea that it's just sort of like there below the street. It's really great stuff, and that's sort of contributed to by the costumes and the makeup and the design. which I think look great. You know, some of the costumes really stand out. In particular, I think the Marquis de Carabas in his sort of almost pantomime coat that he gets to swing out behind him at, with great relish. He has fun with his costume.
Yes, the BBC have always been good at doing costumes that belong in historical or sort of surreal but related to historical settings. And they did that in this and did it very well, I thought. And even watching more than 10 years later, the costumes, on the whole, don't really seem that dated. And that, I think, shows that it was, that they were well done.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the downside of the big performances, the memorable performances, is that some of the other characters have to work a bit harder for our attention. They're given, in a way, slightly less dramatic stuff to do. So the characters of Richard and Dor and, to a certain extent, Hunter, I think they have to... they have to work a bit harder. When they get their moments, they have to go for them, because there's a risk that they get overshadowed by Krupp, Vandemar and de Carabas.
Yes, those performances were definitely a weaker part of this show, because especially with Dor and at times Richard, they just weren't engaging enough. Dor is an interesting character, but it's hard for that character to be really engaging because it's such a simple sort of ordinary type of character in this surreal, fantastic type of world.
Yeah, I think so. As I say, you know, we're more interested when the bad guys or the Marquis de Carabas appear. They really capture our attention. The look of Neverwhere in this TV production, I mean, we've mentioned they had this problem of the intended switch from the video look to a film look by putting it through a special filter, which never happened. That sort of caused the problems. I know some people find that an issue when they watch the series.
That does tend to make some of it look more like a TV studio. It makes some things like the floating markets and so on look very exaggerated dark and exaggerated light where the lights are, without a lot of degradation between them and without a lot of detail in the dark places. So you do have some problems there. I don't think it detracted from it too much, in part because some of the locations, the rooftops and the subway stations and the like, really look good and sort of added to it. And the sets were not terrible. You know, they were, you know, some of them were a little weak for these reasons, and some of them looked quite good. So you have a mix there.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, none of the sets are sort of wobbly or flimsy. Some of them do look a bit like a TV studio. And as you say, with the bits where it actually gets into real London and onto the London rooftops in particular, they look great. So impressive, I think.
Yes, they do look very good. What do you think about the story being told in this length and this number of episodes as they did it?
I was quite happy with the 6 episodes. I didn't feel that was too long. I suppose it does suffer slightly from the sort of third quarter problem where all these series tend to sag a little bit. But my feeling really about the length of it was actually I wanted to see more Neverwhere afterwards. I wanted to find out more about the world of Neverwhere. What about yourself, Brian?
I thought the length was pretty good. If anything, what bugged me was the pacing, and that the third quarter issue didn't bother me so much. It was more the beginning. The first couple episodes seemed to have slightly strange pacing. It was as if I didn't know where the story was going for that first chunk of it. And it just seemed a little off at that point, where it was just we're going from here to here to here, but no particular reason why. Once it got over that, I thought the pacing and the length was great. And even at the beginning, it's not too bad. It still works, but it didn't feel quite as directed as I'd like it to. It was good, but it didn't quite have that strong sense of direction there.
Right. Okay. Which it sort of picks up later on in the series.
I think it does. All in all, you know, we're finding flaws here, and there are some. But all in all, this is a pretty good show. It's well worth watching. I do like it. I really do.
Yeah, absolutely. So if people are going to watch it, we need to discuss the availability. In Region 2, UK and the Europe, it's available on DVD, which came out in 2007, which is currently available on Amazon for a £5 bargain price. So I think one of the cheapest
shows we've talked about on British Invaders.
The DVD includes a commentary from Neil Gaiman, which I've listened to about half of, and contains lots of interesting information, including the fact that Neil Gaiman thought that Patterson Joseph would have made a good Doctor Who, and he's not the only one who thought that.
That's true.
And that he intended the character of Marquis de Carabas to be a bit like one of the earlier Doctors he mentions on the commentary. And it's also available on the British DVD rental sites as well, so it's fairly easy to get hold of in Region 2.
And it's easy to get hold of in Region 1 as well. The Region 1 DVD actually came out a couple years earlier. It came out in 2005. It's one of these A&E DVD releases that we see quite a few of over here in North America. It runs for about $20 on the Amazon.com marketplace, so it is a little bit more expensive. So it certainly is available and easy to get hold of.
So, our recommendations. I know how this one is going to go for us, Brian. I think we're fairly positive, aren't we?
I think so. It certainly isn't perfect. There are issues with Neverwhere and some of the look and some of the performances and a few things like that. But it's a great story. It has some great performances in it, and even the weaker performances, I think, are okay. It's well worth watching. It has a wonderful world in it that they build, and some great ideas, and a really good story. So if those are the things that you're interested in and you want to follow, which they certainly are for me, then check out Neverwhere if you haven't seen it. It's worth watching. It's really a fun show.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a double thumbs up this time on British Invaders. I'd agree with you, Brian. It's not a perfect show, but it's one of the ones I've had the most fun watching for British Invaders, I think, since we talked about Jekyll. And the reasons, I think I'm going to just do a quick list of names as reasons to watch it, and those names would be Neil Gaiman, Dave McKean, Brian Eno, Patterson Joseph, and Misters Croup and Vandemar. All that for £5. It's an absolute bargain, and I'd really recommend it.
Yes, it's good stuff. So, in summary, Neverwhere was a 1996 fantasy TV series that was by Neil Gaiman, also with Lenny Henry, and it delved into this idea of there being London above and London below. So there was a hidden world below London in the subways and alleys and rooftops where people who we might think of as homeless were ignored by everyone, but had a fantasy world all of their own with strange creatures and fantastic powers and a feudal system and this whole world into and of itself. And we follow Richard Mayhew as he goes from our world of London above down into London below and has this whole quest and adventure and meets all sorts of people, and we're introduced to lots of places based on British tube stations and all sorts of things.
Yep, it's great stuff. We really enjoyed watching it. Next time on British Invaders, we'll be revisiting one of our favourites yet again. We're back in the world of Nigel Neal, and we're bringing you a 1970s classic scary story, a TV film called The Stone Tape.
Yes, that is an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great fun.
So you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you go to Facebook and search for British Invaders, you will find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much for listening. Do drop by the Facebook group and find out what other shows we've got coming up. And until next time, Damon from England saying goodbye.